Chapter 7. The God Machine. A Favour. Subterfuge. The cold sensation snaking through Kassar's mind was like an old friend, the touch of something reassuring. The metallic caress of the Dies Irae as its cortical interfaces meshed with his consciousness would have been terrifying to most people, but it was one of the few constants Moderati Titus Kassar had left in the galaxy. That and the Lactitio Divinitatis. The Titan's bridge was dim, lit by ghostly readouts and telltales that lined the ornate bridge in hard greens and blues. The Mechanicum had been busy, sending cloaked adepts into the Titan, and the bridge was packed with equipment he didn't yet know the purpose of. The deck crew manning the plasma reactor at the war machine's heart had been readying the Titan for battle since the vengeful spirit arrived in the Istvan system. And every indication was that the Dies Irae's major systems were all functioning better than ever. Kassar was glad of any advantage the war machine could get, but somewhere, deep down, he resented the thought of anyone else touching the Titan. The interface filaments coiled deeper into his scalp, sending an unexpected chill through him. The Titan's systems lit up behind Kassar's eyes as though they were part of his own body. The plasma reactor was ticking over quietly, its pent-up energy ready to erupt into full battle order at his command. "Motivation systems are a little loose," he said to himself, tightening the pressure on the massive hydraulic rams in the Titan's torso and legs. "Weapons hot? Ammunition loaded?" he said, knowing that it would take no more than a thought to unleash them. He had come to regard the power and magnificence of the Dies Irae as the Emperor personified. Kassar had resisted the thought at first, mocking Jonah Arukin's insistence that the Titan had a soul, but it had become more and more obvious why he had been chosen by the saint. The Lactitio Divinitatis was under threat, and the faithful had to be defended. He almost laughed aloud as the thought formed, but what he had seen on the Medicaid deck had only deepened the strength of his conviction that he had chosen the right path. The Titan was a symbol of that strength, an avatar of divine wrath, a god-machine that brought the Emperor's judgment to the sinners of Istvan. "The Emperor protects," whispered Kassar, his voice drifting down through the layers of readouts in his mind. "And he destroys."
"Does he now?"
Kassar snapped out of his thoughts, and the Titan's systems retreated beneath his consciousness. He looked up in sudden panic, but let out a relieved breath as he saw Moderati Arukin standing over him. Arukin snapped a switch, and the bridge lights flickered to life.
"Be careful who hears you, Titus, now more than ever."
"I was running through pre-battle checks," said Kassar.
"Of course you were, Titus. If Princeps Turnit hears you say things like that, you'll be for it."
"My thoughts are my own, Jonah. Not even the Princeps can deny me that."
"You really believe that? Come on, Titus. You know full well this cult stuff isn't welcome. We were lucky on the Medicaid deck, but this is bigger than you and me, and it's getting too dangerous."
"We can't back away from it now," said Kassar. "Not after what we saw."
"I'm not even sure what I saw," said Arukin defensively.
"You're joking, surely?"
"No," insisted Arukin. "I'm not. Look, I'm telling you this because you're a good man, and the Dies Irae will suffer if you're not here. She needs a good crew, and you're part of it."
"Don't change the subject," said Kassar. "We both know that what we saw on the Medicaid deck was a miracle. You have to accept that before the Emperor can enter your heart."
"Listen, I've been hearing some scuttlebutt on the deck, Titus," said Arukin, leaning closer. "Turnit's been asking questions about us. He's asking about how deep this runs, as though we're part of some hidden conspiracy. It's as if he doesn't trust us anymore."
"Let him come."
"You don't understand. When we're in battle, we're a good team. And if we get, I don't know, thrown in a cell or worse, that team gets broken up, and there isn't a better crew for the Dies Irae than us. Don't let this saint business break that up. The Crusade will suffer for it."
"My faith won't allow me to make compromises, Jonah."
"Well, that's all it is," snapped Arukin. "Your faith."
"No," said Titus, shaking his head. "It's your faith too, Jonah. You just don't know it yet."
Arukin didn't answer, and slumped into his own command chair, nodding at the readouts in front of Kassar.
"How's she looking?"
Good. The reactor is ticking over smoothly, and the targeting is reacting faster than I've seen it in a while. The Mechanicum adepts have been tinkering, so there are a few more bells and whistles to play with.
You say that as if it's a bad thing, Titus. The Mechanicum know what they're doing. Anyway, the latest news is that we've got 12 hours to go before the drop. We're going in with the Death Guard on support duties. Princeps Turnit will brief us in a few hours, but it's basically pounding the ground and scaring the shit out of the enemy. Sound good?
It sounds like battle.
It's all the same thing for the DS era when the bullets are flying, said Arukan.
This reminds me of why I was so proud, said Logan,
looking at the spear tip assembling on the Vengeful Spirit's embarkation deck.
Joining the Mournival, and just to be a part of this.
I'm still proud, said Torgadden. This is my legion. That hasn't changed.
Loken and Torgadden, fully armoured and ready for the drop, stood at the head of a host of Astartes. More than a third of the legion was there, thousands of warriors arrayed for war. Loken saw veterans alongside newly inducted novices, assault warriors with chainswords and bulky jump packs, and devastators hefting heavy bolters and las cannons. Sergeant Lacoste was speaking with his communications squad, making sure they understood the importance of keeping a link with the Vengeful Spirit once they were down in the Coral City. Apothecary Vadden was checking and rechecking his medical gear. The Narthesium gauntlet with its cluster of probes and the reductor that would harvest gene seed from the fallen. Yakton Cruz, who had been a captain for so long that he was as old as an Astartes could be and still count himself a warrior, was lecturing some of the more recent inductees on the past glories of the Legion that they had to live up to.
I'd be happier with the 10th, said Logan,
returning his attention to his friend.
And I with the 2nd, replied Torgadden. But we can't always have what we want.
Garvey, called a familiar voice.
Logan turned and saw Nero Vipers approaching them, leaving the veterans of Lacasta to continue their preparations for the drop.
Nero, said Logan. Good to have you with us.
Vipers clapped Loken's shoulder guard with the augmetic hand that had replaced the organic one he'd lost on 6319.
I wouldn't have missed this, he said.
I know what you mean, replied Logan.
It had been a long time since they had lined up on the Vengeful Spirit as brothers, ready to fight the Emperor's good fight. Nero Vipers and Logan were the oldest of friends, back from the barely remembered blur of training, and it was reassuring to have another familiar face alongside him.
"Have you heard the reports from Istvan Extremis?"
asked Vipers, his eyes alight.
"Some of them."
"They say the enemy has got some kind of psychic leadership caste, and that their soldiers are fanatics. My collar's up just thinking about it."
"Don't worry," said Torgadden. "I'm sure you'll kill them all."
"It's like Davin again," said Vipers, baring his teeth in a grimace of anticipation.
"It's not like Davin,"
said Logan.
"There's nothing at all like Davin."
"What do you mean?"
"It's not a bloody swamp for a start,"
interjected Torgadden.
"It would be an honour if you'd go into battle with Lacasta, Garvey,"
said Vipers expectantly.
"I have a space in the drop pod."
"The honour is mine,"
replied Logan, taking his friend's hand as a sudden thought occurred to him.
"Count me in."
He nodded to his friends and made his way through the bustling Astartes towards the solitary figure of Yakton Cruz. The half-herd watched the preparations for war with undisguised envy, and Logan felt a stab of sympathy for the venerable warrior. Cruz was an example of just how little even the Legion's apothecaries knew of an Astartes' physiology. His face was as battered and gnarled as ancient oak, but his body was as wolf-tough, honed by years of fighting and not yet made weary by age. An Astartes was functionally immortal, meaning that only in death did duty end, and the thoughts sent a chill down Loken's spine.
"Loken,"
acknowledged Cruz as he saw him approach.
"You're not coming down to see the sights of the Siren Hold with us?"
asked Loken.
"Alas, no," said Cruz. "I am to stay and await orders. I haven't even got a place in the order of battle for the Pacification Force."
"If the War Master has no plans for you, Yakton, then I have something you could do for me," said Logan, "if you would do me the honour."
Cruz's eyes narrowed.
"What sort of a favour?"
"Nothing too arduous, I promise you."
"Then ask."
"There are some remembrances aboard. You may have heard of them. Mercedes Ollerton, Euphrates Keeler,
and Kirill Sinderman.
Yes, I know of them, confirmed Cruz. What of them?
They are friends of mine, and I would consider it an honour if you were to seek them out and ask after them. Check on them, and make sure that they are well.
Why do these mortals matter to you, Captain?
They keep me honest, Yakton, smiled Logan, and they remind me of everything we ought to be as Astartes.
That I can understand, Logan, replied Cruz.
The Legion is changing, boy. I know you've heard me bore you with this before, but I feel in my bones that there's something big just over the horizon that we can't see. If these people help keep us honest, then that's good enough for me. Consider it done, Captain Logan.
Thank you, Yakton, said Logan. It means a lot to me.
Don't mention it, boy, grinned Cruz.
Now, get out of here and kill for the living.
I will, promised Logan, taking Cruz's wrist in the warrior's grip.
Spear-tip units to posts, said the booming voice of the deck officer. Good hunting in the siren hold, said Cruz. Lupercal, Lupercal, echoed Logan.
As he jogged towards Locasta's drop pod, it almost felt as if the events of Darwin were forgotten, and Logan was just a warrior again, fighting a crusade that had to be won, and an enemy that deserved to die. It took war to make him feel like one of the sons of Horus again.
To victory! Shouted Lucius.
The Emperor's children were so certain of the perfection of their way of war that it was traditional to salute the victory before it was won. Tarvitz was not surprised that Lucius led the salute. Many senior officers attended the pre-battle celebration, and Lucius was keen to be noticed. The Astartes seated at the lavish banquet around him joined his salute, their cheers echoing from the alabaster walls of the banqueting hall. Captured banners, honoured weapons once carried by the Chosen of Fulgrim, and murals of heroes dispatching alien foes hung from the walls, glorious reminders of past victories. The Primarch himself was not present, thus it fell to Eidolon to take his place at the feast, exhorting his fellow Astartes to celebrate the coming victory. Lucius was equally vocal, leading his fellow warriors in toasts from golden chalices of fine wine. Tarvitz set down his goblet and rose from the table.
"Leaving already, Tarvitz?" sneered Eidolon.
"Yes," chimed in Lucius. "We've only just begun to celebrate."
"I'm sure you will do enough celebrating for both of us, Lucius," said Tarvitz. "I have matters to attend to before we make the drop."
"Nonsense," said Lucius. "You need to stay with us and regale us with memories of murder and how I helped you defeat the scourge of the Megarachnids."
The warriors cheered and called for Tarvitz to tell the story once more, but he held up his hands to quiet their demands.
"Why don't you tell it, Lucius?" asked Tarvitz. "I don't think I build your part up enough for your liking anyway."
"That's true," smiled Lucius. "Very well, I'll tell the tale."
"Lord Commander,"
said Tarvitz, bowing to Eidolon and then turning to make his way through the golden door of the banquet hall. Appealing to Lucius's vanity was the surest way of deflecting his attention. Tarvitz would miss the camaraderie of the celebration, but he had other matters pressing on his thoughts. He closed the door to the banqueting hall as Lucius began the tale of their ill-fated expedition to murder, though its horrifying beginnings had somehow become a great triumph, largely thanks to Lucius, if past retellings were anything to go by. The magnificent processional at the heart of the Andronius was quiet, the droning hum of the vessel reassuring in its constancy. The ship, like many in the Emperor's Children fleet, resembled some ancient palace of terror, reflecting the Legion's desire to infuse everything with regal majesty. Tarvitz made his way through the ship, passing wondrous spaces that would make the shipwrights of Jupiter weep with awe, until he reached the Hall of Rites, the circular chamber where the Emperor's Children underwent the oaths and ceremonies that tied them to their legion. Compared to the rest of the ship, the hall was dark, but it was no less magnificent. Marble columns supporting a distant domed ceiling, and ritual altars of marble glittering in pools of shadow at its edges. Fulgrim's Chosen had pledged themselves to the Primarch's personal charge here, and he had accepted his appointment as captain before the altar of service. The Hall of Rites replaced opulence with gravity, and seemed designed to intimidate with the promise of knowledge hidden from all but the Legion's most exalted officers. Tarbitz paused on the threshold, seeing the unmistakable shape of ancient Rylanor, his dreadnought body standing before the altar of devotion.
"Enter,"
said Rylanor in his artificial voice. Tarbitz cautiously approached the ancient, his blocky outline resolving into a tank-like sarcophagus supported on powerful piston legs. The dreadnought's wide shoulders mounted an assault cannon on one arm and a huge hydraulic fist on the other. Rylanor's body rotated slowly on its central axis to face Tarbitz, turning from the book of ceremonies that lay open on the altar.
"Captain Tarbitz, why are you not with your warriors?" asked Rylanor.
His ocular circuits regarded Tarbitz without emotion.
"They can celebrate well enough without me," said Tarbitz. "Besides, I have sat through one too many renditions of Lucius's tales to think I'll miss much."
"It is not to my taste either,"
said Rylanor, a grating bark of electronic noise sounding from the dreadnought's vox unit. At first, Tarbitz thought the ancient had developed a fault, until he realized that the sound was Rylanor's laughter. Rylanor was the Legion's ancient of rites, and when not on the battlefield, he oversaw the ceremonies that marked the gradual ascent of an Astartes from novice to chosen of Fulgrim. Decades before, Rylanor had been wounded beyond the skill of the Legion's apothecaries while fighting the duplicitous Eldar, and had been interred in a dreadnought war machine that he might continue to serve. Along with Lucius and Tarbitz, Rylanor was one of the senior officers being sent down to take the Coral City's palace complex.
"I wish to speak with you, revered ancient," said Tarbitz, "about the drop."
"The drop is in a few hours," replied Rylanor. "There is little time."
"Yes. I have left it too late, and for that I apologize, but it concerns Captain Odovakar."
"Captain Odovakar is dead. Killed on Istvan Extremis."
"And the Legion lost a great warrior that day,"
nodded Tarbitz.
"Not only that, but he was to function as Eidolon's senior staff officer aboard the Andronius, relaying the commander's orders to the surface. With his death, there is no one to fulfill that role."
"Eidolon is aware of Odovakar's loss. He will have an alternative in place."
"I request the honor of fulfilling that role," said Tarbitz solemnly. "I knew Odovakar well, and would consider it a fitting tribute to finish the work he began on this campaign."
The dreadnought leaned close to Tarbitz, the cold metallic machine unreadable, as the crippled warrior within decided Tarbitz's fate.
"You would renounce the honor of your place in the spear tip to take over his duties."
Tarbitz looked into Rylanor's optics, struggling to keep his expression neutral. Rylanor had seen everything the Legion had gone through since the beginning of the Great Crusade, and was said to be able to perceive a lie the instant it was told. His request to remain aboard the Andronius was highly unusual, and Rylanor would surely be suspicious of his motives for not wanting to go into the fight. But when Tarbitz had learned that Eidolon was not leading the spear tip personally, he knew there had to be a reason. The Lord Commander never passed up the opportunity to flaunt his martial prowess, and for him to appoint another in his stead was unheard of. Not only that, but the deployment orders Eidolon had issued made no sense. Instead of the normal, rigorously regimented order of battle that was typical of an Emperor's children assault, the units chosen to make the first attack appeared to have been picked at random. The only thing they had in common was that none were from chapters led by Eidolon's favoured Lord Commanders. For Eidolon to sanction a drop without any of the warriors belonging to those Lord Commanders was unheard of and grossly insulting. Something felt very wrong about this drop, and Tarbitz couldn't shake the feeling that there was some grim purpose behind the selection of these units. He had to know what it was. Rylanor straightened and said,
"I shall see to it that you are replaced." "This is a great sacrifice you make, Captain Tarbitz. You do the memory of Odovakar much honour with it."
Tarbitz fought to hide his relief, knowing that he had taken an unthinkable risk in lying to Rylanor. He nodded and said,
"My thanks, ancient."
"I shall join the troops of the spear tip," said the dreadnought. "Their feasting will soon be complete, and I must ensure that they are ready for battle."
"Bring perfection to the Coral City," said Tarbitz.
guide us well, replied Ragnar, his voice loaded with unspoken meaning. Tarvitz was suddenly certain that the Dreadnought wanted Tarvitz to remain on the ship.
Do the Emperor's work, Captain Tarvitz, ordered Ragnar.
Tarvitz saluted and said,
I will.
As Ragnar set off across the Hall of Rites towards the banquet, his every step heavy and pounding. Tarvitz watched him go, wondering if he would ever see the Ancient again.
The dormitories tucked into the thick walls running the length of the gantry were dark and hot, and from the doorway Mercity could see down into the engine compartment, where the crew were indistinguishable sweating figures who worked in the infernal heat and ruddy glow of the plasma reactors. They hurried across gangways that stretched between the titanic reactors and clambered along massive conduits that hung like spiderwebs in the hellish gloom. She dabbed sweat from her brow at the heat and close confines of the engine space, unused to the searing air that stole away her breath and left her faint.
Mercedes, said Cinderbin, coming to meet her along the gantry.
The iterator had lost weight, his dirty robes hanging from his already spare frame, but his face was alight with the relief and joy of seeing her. The two embraced in a heartfelt hug, both grateful beyond words to see each other. She felt tears pricking her eyes at the sight of the old man, unaware until this moment of how much she had missed him.
Kirill, it's so good to see you again, she sobbed. You just vanished. I thought they'd got to you. I didn't know what had happened to you.
Hush, Mercedes, said Cinderman. It's all right. I'm so sorry I couldn't send word to you at the time. You must understand that had I a choice, I would have done everything I could to keep you out of this, but I don't know what to do any more. We can't keep her down here forever.
Mercedes looked through the doorway of the dormitory room they stood outside, wishing she had the courage to believe, as Kirill did.
Don't be ridiculous, Kirill. I'm glad you made contact. I thought Malachurst or Maggard had killed you.
Maggard very nearly did, said Cinderman. But the saint saved us.
She saved you? Asked Mercedes. How?
I don't know, exactly. But it was just like in the archive chamber. The power of the Emperor was in her. I saw it, Mercedes, just as sure as you're standing here before me. I wish you could have seen it.
I wish that too, she said,
surprised to find that she meant it. She entered the dormitory and stared down at the still form of Euphrati Keeler on the thin cot bed, looking for all the world as if she was simply sleeping. The small room was cramped and dirty, with a thin blanket spread on the deck beside the bed. Winking starlight streamed in through a small porthole vision block, something greatly prized this deep in the ship, and without asking, she knew that someone had happily volunteered to give up their prized room for the use of the saint and her companion. Even down here in the dark and the stink, faith flourished.
I wish I could believe, said Mercedes,
watching the rhythmic rise and fall of Euphrates' chest. Cinderman said,
You don't?
I don't know, she said,
shaking her head.
Tell me why I should. What does believing mean to you, Kirill?
He smiled and took her hand.
It gives me something to hold on to. There are people on this ship who want to kill her. And somehow, don't ask me how, I just know that I need to keep her safe.
Are you not afraid? She asked.
Afraid, he said. I've never been more terrified in my life, my dear. But I have to hope that the Emperor is watching over me. That gives me strength and the will to face that fear.
You are a remarkable man, Kirill.
I'm not remarkable, Mercedes, said Cinderman, shaking his head. I was lucky. I saw what the saint did, so faith is easy for me. It's hardest for you have seen nothing. You have to simply accept that the Emperor is working through Euphrates, but you don't believe, do you?
Mercedes turned from Cinderman and pulled her hand from his, looking through the porthole at the void of space beyond.
No, I can't. Not yet.
A white streak shot across the porthole like a shooting star. Another followed it, and then another.
What's that?
She asked. Cinderman leaned over to get a better look through the porthole. Even through his exhaustion, she could see the strength in him that she had previously taken for granted, and she blink-clicked the image, capturing the defiance and bravery she saw in his features. "Drop pods," he said, pointing at a static gleaming object, stark against the blackness and closer to Istvan III. Tiny sparks began raining from its underside towards the planet below.
"I think that's the Andronius, Fulgrim's flagship," said Cinderman. "Looks like the attack we've been hearing about has begun. Imagine how it would be if we could watch it unfolding."
Euphrates groaned, and the attack on Istvan III was forgotten as they slid across to sit beside her. Mercedes saw Cinderman's love for her clearly as he mopped her brow, her skin so clean that it practically shone. For the briefest moment, Mercedes saw how people could believe Euphrates was miraculous. Her body, so pale and fragile, yet untouched by the world around her. Mercedes had known Keela as a gutsy woman, never afraid to speak her mind or bend the rules to get the magnificent Picts for which she was rightly famed. But now she was something else entirely.
"Is she coming round?" asked Mercedes.
"No," said Cinderman sadly.
"She makes noises, but she never opens her eyes. It's such a waste. Sometimes I swear she's on the brink of waking, but then she sinks back down into whatever hell she's going through in her head."
Mercedes sighed and looked back out into space. The pinpoints of light streaked in their hundreds towards Istvan III. As the spear tip was driven home, she whispered,
"Loken."
The Coral City was magnificent. Its design was a masterpiece of architecture, light and space, so wondrous that Peter Egan Momus had begged the War Master not to assault so brutally. Older by millennia than the Imperium that had come to claim it in the name of the Emperor, its precincts and thoroughfares were soon to become blood-slick battlefields. While the juggernaut of compliance had made the galaxy a sterile, secular place, the Coral City remained a city of the gods. The Precentor's Palace, a dizzying creation of gleaming marble blades and arches that shone in the sun, opened like a vast stone orchid to the sky, and the polished granite of the city's wealthiest districts clustered around it like worshippers. Momus had described the palace as a hymn to power and glory, a symbol of the divine right by which Istvan III would be ruled. Further out from the palace, and beyond the architectural perfection of the Coral City, vast, multi-layered residential districts sprawled. Connected by countless walkways and bridges of glass and steel, the avenues between them were wide canyons of tree-lined boulevards in which the citizens of the Coral City lived. The city's industrial heartland rose like climbing skeletons of steel against the eastern mountains, belching smoke as they churned out weapons to arm the planet's armies. War was coming, and every Isvanian had to be ready to fight. But no sight in the Coral City compared to the Siren Hold. Not even the magnificence of the palace outshone the Siren Hold, its towering walls defining the Coral City with their immensity. The brutal battlements diminished everything around them, and the sacred fortress of the Siren Hold humbled even the snow-capped peaks of the mountains. Within its walls, enormous tomb spires reached for the skies, their walls encrusted with monumental sculptures that told the legends of Istvan's mythical past. The legends told that Istvan himself had sung the world into being, with music that could still be heard by the blessed war singers, and that he had borne countless children with whom he populated the first ages of the world. They became night and day, ocean and mountain, a thousand legends whose breath could be felt in every moment of every day in the Coral City. Darker carvings told of the lost children, the sons and daughters who had forsaken their father and been banished to the blasted wasteland of the fifth planet, where they became monsters that burned with jealousy and raised black fortresses from which to brood upon their expulsion from paradise. War, treachery, revelation and death all marched around the Siren Hold in endless cycles of myth, the weight of their meaning, pinning the Coral City to the soil of Istvan III and infusing its every inhabitant with their sacred purpose. The gods of Istvan III were set to sleep in the Siren Hold, whispering their murderous plots in the nightmares of children and ancients. For a time, the myths and legends had remained as distant as they had always been. But now they walked among the people of the Coral City, and every breath of wind shrieked that the lost children had returned. Without knowing why, the populace of Istvan III had armed and unquestioningly followed the orders of Varda's prow to defend their city. An army of well-equipped soldiers awaited the invasion they had long been promised was coming in the western marches of the city, where the war singers had sung a formidable web of trenches into being. Artillery pieces parked in the gleaming canyons of the city pointed their barrels westwards, set to pound any invaders into the ground before they reached the trenches. The warriors of the Coral City would then slaughter any that survived in carefully prepared crossfire. The defences had been meticulously planned, protecting the city from attack from the west, the only direction in which an invasion could be launched. Or so the soldiers manning the defences had been told. The first omen was a fire in the sky that came with the dawn. A scattering of falling stars streaked through the blood-red dawn, burning through the sky like fiery tears. The sentries in the trenches saw them falling in bright spears of fire, the first burning object smashing into the trenches amid a plume of mud and flame. At the speed of thought, the word raced around the Coral City that the lost children had returned, that the prophecies of myth were coming true. They were proven right when the drop pods burst open and the Astartes of the Death Guard Legion emerged, and the killing began.